no need to fear.
Explosion.
Come, Arthur. Evil is afoot.
Afoot? That's funny.
I have only seconds to shed my everyday disguise. This looks like a job for...
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Help! Help! There's no need to fear.
Help! Help! Help!
I say to you, stop your evil ways.
Hi, everybody. If you experience that introduction, it's a little disorienting. It is a probably put your mind in about the right space for the coming presentation. This is a I gave serious thought to putting a whole series of parental warnings and content advisories at the beginning here, because this presentation is full of disturbing material, full of disorienting material, full of explicitly racist material that in my view simply needs to be acknowledged as sort of part of the reality of the American experience. So that's what we're going to do. My suspicion is that I'm not going to have a time in this video to kind of wrap it all up with a very cheerful bottom line. It's just a pretty dark presentation, a pretty troubling presentation. But I think it's necessary to understand the experience of addiction in the American experience. Now, normally, if you talk to the average person about addictions, they're not likely to think that it's going to be a conversation about racism. It's just those are two different universes, addiction and racism. But in our actual lived historical experience, racism and addiction are joined at the hip. And it's really important for us to take a look at that. Most of what appears in this presentation is stuff I've known for quite a while, but I knew these things as kind of little isolated bits and pieces. And there was something about preparing this lecture and seeing, sort of connecting the dots between all of this stuff, that was deeply troubling for me, but also has, I can tell, already had a significant impact on my understanding of what's going on when Americans talk about racism and addiction. Now, I think it's perfectly fair to acknowledge up front that I'm going to spend almost all our time talking about the connections between racism and addiction in the American experience. This should not be taken to mean that America is the only place where you see this. In fact, there's many, many other examples I could give of racism in other cultural contexts that is connected with addictions. Just briefly, the British fought two wars with the Chinese, fueled by Chinese racism in the early 19th century, the so-called Opium Wars, in order to protect their ability to be drug dealers in China. That's a really important historical thing. It connects racism and addiction in a powerful way, but we don't have time to talk about that. Japanese, prior to the American involvement in what we call World War II, and I think pretty much the Chinese call it the anti-Japanese war, the Japanese, when they took over large chunks of China and Manchuria, they set out to raise opium on an industrial scale in Manchuria, where the climate was friendly for that kind of activity, and to distribute it widely to sort of pacify the occupied Chinese. So there's lots of connections between addiction and racism around the world, but for our purposes, it's important for us to look closely at what that looks like in the American experience. I say closely, but the truth is we're just going to skim over the surface Now, to give you a sense of the range of material that's present here. But let's, the methodology I'm going to use here is I'm going to, again, do kind of an historical survey. We'll start with the colonial period and work our way forward, looking at addictive substances as they sort of emerge to prominence in different periods of our history. So, a few comments about the colonial period. European occupation of North America faced two principal hurdles. The first was the fact that a bunch of people already lived here, and so you had to have some sort of strategy for dealing with the Native American tribes. And the second problem was primarily an economic one. Is you can send people to start colonies, but the colonies are not going to be sustainable unless they're economically viable. And what can they do to be economically viable? You can't raise vegetables and send them back to Britain. It takes 3 to 4 weeks to go from Boston to Portsmouth in those days. And so your produce would rot. So you have to have durable items. In the northern colonies, they could do animal pelts, furs, basically do trapping. But in the rest of the colonies, it really came down to creating addictive substances that could be transported over long distances. I'll talk about that in a minute. But first, a few comments about the relationship between addiction and the genocide of Indian tribes in America. We get, I think, a reasonably clear window on this reality from the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was sent by George Washington along with some others in 1753 to a meeting with the leaders of Native American tribes in Ohio to try to cut a peace treaty. He got there part of the deal before this peace treaty with the Indians. This negotiating session was everybody had to show up sober. That was explicit in the pre-negotiation terms. And everybody showed up sober as an enticement to come. Franklin's team told the Indian leaders that they could have as much rum as they wanted once a peace deal had been completed. So once they completed the peace deal, Franklin and his team gave the Indians as much rum as they wanted. They got well and thoroughly drunk. And Franklin talks about them dancing around a bonfire all night long, completely drunk, and getting into fights with each other, drawing blood. He was just appalled by it. And this is what one of the things he says about this event. In his autobiography. If it be the design of Providence to extirpate, to completely destroy these savages in order to make room for cultivators of the earth, it seems not improbable that rum may be the appointed means. It has already annihilated all the tribes who formerly inhabited the seacoast. So, Franklin understands the way in which European colonists dealt with Native American tribes as A, the action of Providence. This was something kind of God was doing, not the European settlers. And the what God had done was to weaponize rum. Rum becomes the means to destroy Native American tribes. Now, it's not hard to see the racism at work here. Let's not forget the sort of views of European settlers about Indians. To be fair, there was constant conflict in those early years. Lots of raids by Indians on settlements and vice versa. And very, very negative views of Native Americans. Jonathan Edwards, who was actually thought of as a progressive in terms of his attitudes towards Native Americans. So was a long-term supporter all his life for the funding of Native American schools. Well, long-term supporter of English language schools for Native Americans, not quite the same thing. But his view of Native Americans and how they came to be in North America was that it goes back to the 3rd century. His view was that the Christian movement had been so wildly successful in the first 3 centuries, taking over the Roman Empire, that Satan was worried that there'd be no one left to worship him. So Satan gathered together a bunch of his followers and transported them by mechanisms unknown to North America. And those are the ancestors of the Native American tribes. They are the ancestors of Satan worshipers. That's pretty racist stuff. I don't think we should give Jonathan Edwards a pass on that, no matter how brilliant he may have been at some other things. So here you see a pretty significant connection between one of the major problems of surviving, of Europeans surviving in North America, and addictive substances, primarily rum. Now, I probably should mention that this weaponization of alcoholic beverages, it was not a new idea to Benjamin Franklin. It's a very old idea. Here, I think, is a quote from Tacitus, the Roman historian, who, talking about the Teutonic tribes, basically Middle European tribes, I think, France and Germany today. This is a quote from Kamenetsky in his book called Shooting Up, which is a history of the weaponization of addictive substances. Tacitus saw the Teutonic passion for intoxication as a major weakness that could and should be exploited. Thus he advised, quote, "If you will but humor their excess in drinking and supply them with as much as they covet, it will be no less easy to vanquish them by vices than by arms." So the weaponization of alcoholic beverages goes way back, and its use against Native American tribes was just one of the more recent examples of that. So let's talk about the second major threat to the survival of European colonies in North America, and that had to do with an economic issue. It had to do with the economics of colonialism. Colonialism was, and always has been, very expensive. It takes a lot of money to pull off colonial exercises. Your supply lines are very long, and you have to, let's just use Britain again as an example. Somebody has to find some donors with very deep pockets who are willing to invest in the attempt to establish a viable colony. You have to have enough money to hire boats and crew. You have to have enough stuff to survive the first year because none of your crops are going to come up until a year after you arrive. And then you have to resupply for a period of time. The premise is that the colony will produce something of significant value. Now, maybe it was the hope that they'd find, cities with streets paved with gold and that kind of thing. But for the most part, it was, there was a very pragmatic approach to this. We need something of relatively high value that we can ship back and sell in the international marketplace. Now, there were two problems, sort of secondary problems that had to be solved. One was because the viable candidates for a colony saving product were either you're either going to produce alcoholic beverages or you're going to produce tobacco. Those were the two main products which contributed, both addictive substances, which contributed to the viability of American colonies. The production of both, however, was very labor intensive. So you had to have a sort of labor force. And the available labor force was in Africa. Now, it'd be a serious misjudgment to think of slavery in entirely economic terms, but for our purposes right now, it's useful to look at that part of things. There's much more going on there than just economics. But the whole idea was there were slaves in Africa that you could trade for. That is, most slave traders didn't go over to Africa send a military force in to capture slaves. There was plenty of inter-tribal conflicts and things like that where slaves were captured. There was a marketplace for them, and they went to that marketplace and purchased slaves. The whole purpose at which were shipped from the west coast of Africa, either in the southern Atlantic slave trade, largely to Brazil, a Portuguese colony at the time, mostly Portuguese slave traders. The rest were shipped to primarily the Caribbean area. Barbados was one of the major arrival points. That was the most productive of the British colonies in the Americas. And so it's maybe 5 million slaves went to Brazil, maybe 4.5 to the Caribbean, and somewhat less than 1 million. Some people say about 500,000, somewhere along those lines, came to what we currently call the United States. Now, the reason what those slaves did when they got to the Caribbean, typically, was they would be the labor force for sugarcane production. It's a very labor-intensive, hard, back-breaking work. So you have all the sugarcane. What you do with your slaves is you take them to Barbados or some other islands in the Caribbean. You trade your slaves for either sugar or molasses, a byproduct of sugar purification. And you fill your boat with that, and you sail your boat up the east coast of the United States to places where there are large refineries who can turn your sugar or your molasses into rum. These were Carolinas, Virginia, as far north as Massachusetts, Boston. And there you trade your molasses or your sugar for a bunch of rum. And if they have other products that are useful, you can take other things as well. And then you take those products back either to the Caribbean area or to England, or sometimes you go straight back to Africa, where you can trade rum for human beings. So the whole purpose of this Atlantic, the international commerce in the North Atlantic area, was to produce a profit. And it was not just produce a profit, it's to produce addictive substances that made it possible for you to make a profit. And it was the labor of African slaves that made that an economically viable enterprise. If you're paying minimum wage, the colonies would all have failed, I think. Some of them didn't really ever make it anyway. Some never paid off their investors. And what you used to a trade for slaves in Africa was largely rum. I think I have a quote about that. Yeah, trading alcohol for slaves. At Luanda, the capital of the Portuguese colony of Angola, of the nearly 1.2 million captives shipped from this port town during 1710 to 1830 alone, 33% have been estimated as purchased through the importation of alcoholic drinks. So alcohol was the whole reason for the trade. It's how you acquired those slaves, by trading alcohol for slaves in roughly a third of the cases. Now, you might wonder why people in Africa would trade human beings for rum. There was lots of domestic production of alcoholic beverages in Africa, have been for a very, very long period of time. Mostly fairly low quality beers. And there was something quite magical about an alcoholic drink that could get you intoxicated very quickly. So it was thought to be high value. People who had wealth already valued that. There was also, in some places, a connection between intoxication and spirituality that we don't have time to talk about now, but there was some sort of spiritual sensibility about having rum. A third connection between addiction and substance abuse and racism connected to the institution of slavery is that alcoholic beverages is what slave owners used to pacify slaves. Here's a quote from Frederick Douglass about that exact thing. This is from a speech he gave in 1846, so before the Civil War. In the southern states, masters induced their slaves to drink whiskey in order to keep them from devising ways and means by which to obtain their freedom. In order to make a man a slave, it's necessary to silence or drown his mind. In no other way can this be so well accomplished as by using ardent spirits. On Saturday evening, it's the custom of the slaveholder to give his slaves drink. And why? Because if they had time to think, if left to reflection on the Sabbath day, they might devise means by which to obtain their liberty. So, production of addictive substances and sale in international commerce was the economic engine of the European colonies in North America. They were all kind of narco colonies. It was what was used to purchase slaves or barter for slaves, and it was how you keep the slaves from resisting their state. I ran across just what I thought was a very, very moving article written somewhere in the 30s, I think, although referenced more recently. It was anthropologist named Melville Herkovitz who did a series of oral histories of people in Dahomey. Dahomey is no longer a country. Now, I think it's somewhere near Angola. I don't know quite where. You can Google it. And in these oral histories, he found multiple cases of Dahomeans telling him about a chant that the Dahomean people would sing. And they sort of performed it for their ancestors and performed it for their loved ones who were enslaved and never to return. This is the chant. The English must bring guns. The Portuguese must bring powder. The Spaniards must bring the small stones that give fire to our fire sticks. The Americans who bring the cloths and the rum made by our kinsmen who are there. For these will permit us to smell their presence. So even the families of people whose family members had been enslaved found something in rum that gave them a connection with the ones who have been stolen from them. It's a lament. There's multiple levels of tragedy here. I found it quite moving. Okay, so that's all about alcohol so far. Let me say a little bit about tobacco. This image is, I think, from a label on a large bundle of tobacco, Virginia Planter's Best Tobacco. Notice the white guy smoking a pipe, being shaded by a slave holding an umbrella, and the black workers in the background with hoes who did all the work. Now, all of the, everything that I said about alcohol in some ways could be repeated here about tobacco. Labor-intensive work. For a period of time, it was not just slave labor, but as things expanded in Virginia and elsewhere, it became dominantly slave labor that made it possible to grow tobacco. So there's that same kind of connection between addictive substances and racism. There's some other things worth mentioning. This is later on when cigarettes become a popular item. Cigarettes, I think I mentioned this in a previous presentation, that industrial scale cigarette manufacture didn't really kick in until about the 1920s, but then there was an enormous amount of marketing to build a long-term market. You have to get enough adolescents addicted to have a viable long-term business plan for tobacco sales. And here are a couple examples of tobacco advertising from the early 20th century. This one doesn't really require very much commentary on my part. It is just so obviously racist, it would be hard to miss it. Notice this small insert of a pack of cigarettes with a African person with an afro. This particular brand of tobacco was apparently very proud about the fact that they cut their tobacco in long strips that were curly. But it was one of many examples of this kind. Clearly they're not intending to build a market among African Americans. But here's another one also, I think, requires no particular commentary on my part. It is about as racist a way of marketing and addictive substances I can imagine. This overweight, overdressed, over-lipsticked African who is goofy in many ways. It's just, astonishingly racist. But this is part of our history. This is 20th century now. This is not our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents. This is starting to get closer to us. Now, in the 20th century, kind of mid-century, when health warnings about tobacco started to kick in, or health concerns, and their sales started to go down, tobacco companies rethought their attitude towards African-American customers. They started to think of them as customers now and started to produce marketing specific for African-Americans. Here's an example of a very typical kind of blaxploitation marketing for a tobacco product. How good it is, that's Winston. I ran across a fascinating title of an article from about this period. It was 1944 in a advertising magazine talking about the emergence of the African-American customer for tobacco. And the title of the article was "The American Negro, an Export Market at Home." An export market at home. Do these people really belong here? No. We're exporting to them, but they happen to be here. We could chew on that one for a long time. Now, it wasn't just alcohol and tobacco, as I think I mentioned earlier, are kind of bedrocks of addiction in the American experience. They're the staple, not going away. treated differently from any other addictive substances. They're available in every grocery store and almost all pharmacies in America. You can buy both alcohol and tobacco because they're treated just like, basically like ordinary products. There's some regulations about them, but they're like a foodstuff, you know, just ordinary, no big deal. I think that's related to the fact that they were existentially important in the colonial period. Without them, colonization might not have worked at all, so we needed them desperately. And that sort of wound its way into the DNA of the American culture. And it's still with us today. Now, the connections between racism and addictive substances are not limited to African Americans. Here is a very telling, I don't know whether it was an editorial, it's probably on the editorial page of some newspaper in, I'm guessing, the 1880s. And it's contrasting Chinese workers in America and the American worker. The Chinese worker, after work, go back to an opium den. They're falling asleep after smoking a pipe. Notice the two Chinese men in the front left were sitting on the floor eating rats. Chinese were rat-eating opium smokers. Now, it's important to know that during this time period, opium was perfectly legal in the United States, primarily consumed by middle-aged American women who got hooked on tonics. I think I gave you an example of that in the presentation about the consumption of addictive substances, paregoric. That was the largest amount of consumption of opiates. But here you have a kind of a weaponization of opium smoking as a threat. The first legislation prohibiting consumption of opium in the United States was a local registration in San Francisco that passed a ban not on opium consumption, but on opium smoking. It was just smoking because only the Chinese smoked opium. Everybody else ate it, drank it, but it was a distinctively Chinese practice to smoke opium. It's one of the least addictive ways of exposing oneself to opium. You can certainly get addicted to smoking opium. But if you don't have very high quality opium and you don't have an expert to pack your opium pipe for you, most of the opium is going to go up in the smoke. This is why in China, at the various periods of time when opium became very popular, wealthy families would have a staff member in their household who did nothing but expertly pack opium pipes, because you can get a much bigger hit if a pro packed the pipe. So the contrast here is clear. On the right side, you see an American worker coming home after a hard day's work to be greeted by his loving family. I don't think it's hard to see the racism here. It's pretty dramatic. If you're a Irish immigrant or a German immigrant, this guy looks like either one of those to me. You're the good guy, and those rat-eating, opium-smoking Asians are the bad guys. Now, this artifact is from late 19th century, probably 1880s, because very shortly, there was an enormous, deeply racist backlash against Chinese workers in the United States. Chinese workers, helped to build the Transcontinental Railroad. They were employed in the California Gold Rush. They played a pretty important roles in the development of American society. But in the 1880s, they were the bad guys. In 1882, the federal government passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, which prohibited any immigration from China for 10 years. And here was, an editorial cartoon from that period that espoused building the Chinese wall around the United States of America. All the bad stuff is out there. You need to prevent it from coming in here. And the way to do that is to build a wall. Does that sound familiar? I'm not going to make too big a point of that, but this notion of building a wall to keep the bad stuff out has never worked. It doesn't work. Okay, let's look briefly at some other addictive substances and the connections with racism. I'll go much more quickly here. Something about cocaine. This is from Sunday New York Times in 1914, about the time cocaine became a thing in the United States. The title of the article is "Negro Cocaine Fiends Are a New Southern Menace." So you have kind of a double racist whammy here. Southern menace means Colombians or Mexican or someone from down south bringing cocaine and giving it to a particularly susceptible audience, the Negro population in the United States. The subtitle, "Murder and Insanity Increasing Among Lower Class Blacks Because They Have Taken to Sniffing Since Deprived of Whiskey by Prohibition." I don't know any evidence to support that conclusion. It's certainly possible that people switched from alcohol to cocaine in the 20s and early 30s, but I think most alcoholics found ways to get their alcohol. There was no, America didn't turn dry when the implementing legislation for the Prohibition Amendment to the Constitution was passed. It got damp. Something about marijuana. This is a headline from an Ogden, Utah Standard. It starts with the question, "Is the Mexican nation locoed by a peculiar weed?" So this is trying to connect marijuana, cannabis with cartels in Mexico before they had that kind of language. The subheading, I think, is very telling. Deadly marijuana, rolled in cigarettes becomes the curse of the Southern Republic and may account for the, quote, bravery of, quote, greaser bandits. Just a little bit of hint of racism there. Greaser bandits who defy the United States. The insanity of Queen Carlotta is accounted for in the familiar historical legend of the poison tea. Queen Carlotta was the Empress of Russia. I think she was the wife of Maximilian, French. I can't remember the details about the Mexican history here, but she had a lifetime of very serious mental illnesses. And here is the explanation for mental illness is the consumption of marijuana. Pretty sketchy evidence. So again, you see the same kind of theme. Something you don't want here is brought here by those people out there. Why are they doing us such harm? The bad people out there who are bringing in addictive substances here. Now, this wasn't just, I've shown you several sort of newspaper headlines. I need to emphasize that this sort of attitude was deeply embedded in the American character by this time. The example that I like, or I think is very telling, has to do with a guy named Henry J. Anslinger. He was the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, so a senior government official. Head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, during five presidencies. I think it was from 1914 to 1964, something like that. It was Hoover, Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, sort of the top policy guy about addictive substances in the U.S. Here are three of a very long series of unbelievably racist statements which he made having to do with addictive substances. There are 100,000 total marijuana smokers in the U.S., and most are Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, and entertainers. There's satanic music, jazz, and swing result from marijuana use. This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and any others. So it's destroying the femininity of our women. You know. The primary reason to outlaw marijuana is its effect on the degenerate races, something he said. And most telling of all, I think, reefer makes darkies think they're as good as white men. This is not some sort of guy hiding out in the hills of Appalachia with sort of uninformed views. This was the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, the person principally responsible for developing federal legislation, like the Harrison Drug Act of 1912, I think. And that sort of deeply, deeply racist worldview is therefore found throughout federal legislation about addictive substances through this entire period. A little later on, again, sort of going historically, you come to amphetamine. Amphetamine was a huge issue starting before World War II, but after, for a significant period of time. It was, you know, how are you going to fight a six-day tank battle in Europe that's continuous? How are you going to stay awake for 6 days? Why are you going to take some form of amphetamine? How are you going to fly a bomber from Canada or Britain over the Atlantic to drop your bombs in Berlin and come back and stay awake the whole time? You're going to take amphetamine. Amphetamine was provided to troops in World War II quite universally. It was also an enormously popular product at home. Amphetamine was not illegal. It was available in every drugstore in America, and I think I talked about this in our the presentation about the consumption of drugs in the American experience. This particular example I want that emphasizes the racialization of addictive substances is a Mickey Mouse cartoon. This is a Mickey Mouse and the Medicine Man. This was a Mickey Mouse comic book from 1952, at which time Mickey Mouse was the iconic American. He was the American everyman. And that makes this particular drama particularly meaningful, I think. Notice in the cover to the issue, this was not part of the regular Mickey Mouse series. This was, you had to save up box tops from some cereal and send it to the manufacturer, and they would, as a reward, send you back this particular Mickey Mouse cartoon comic book. On the cover, you see the Medicine Man looking very scary. He's a very dark-skinned Medicine Man. And Mickey seems afraid and cowering in the corner. Now, as we'll see, this is not the sort of relationship that is manifested in the rest of the comic. So it begins with a Goofy showing up at Mickey's house, and he says, "Hey, Mickey, look what I got." Mickey wakes up, he looks quite alert. He says, "What is it?" Goofy says, "A free sample of some new stuff named Peppo." This is 1951-52. Everybody in America knows Peppo means amphetamine. It's a pepper-upper. It's, you know, Peppo was amphetamine. Mickey's response to this is, "Gosh, I'll get a spoon and we'll try it." he's up to experimentation with mood-altering substances. Goofy takes dib on first taste. Mickey agrees. Goofy says, yum, it tastes like chocolate, and then the mood alteration sets in. And Goofy jumps up, hits the ceiling, knocks some plaster down that drops on Mickey's head. Mickey, having observed the mood alteration and the negative consequences of Goofy's taking this, gets angry. Now look what you did to my ceiling. Goofy responds with the classic response from an addict. Gosh, Mickey, 'twasn't me, it was the pebble. Blame the substance. Mickey, having observed the mood alteration and the negative consequences, says, well, I'll just try it myself. And he takes some. The next panel, he also experiences pretty dramatic mood alteration, but he's channeling it into very positive, or what most people would think of as positive outcomes. I'm going to mow the lawn, paint the house, clean out the attic. Peppa was super. And then it's sort of the narrative pivot of this little narrative. Mickey gets an idea. He says, Goofy, I've got an idea. He grabs Goofy's hand and says, come on. And he says, as they're running, he says, we'll see the druggist and find out who makes Peppa. At which point, Goofy informs him that they didn't get it at the drugstore, but he got it at the medicine show, sort of kind of a lesser level of a little kind of suspicious. He got it from behind a tent at the medicine show. But they go on to the medicine show. Goofy asks, why is it that we're going to get more Peppo? And Mickey says, because we can sell Peppo and make a fortune for ourselves. Here you have the American everyman, the icon of America, the most prominent brand in America at the time, or one of the most prominent brands in America at the time, says, we can make a huge profit selling drugs. So they go into the Peppo tent, and here I left out a whole bunch of frames, a bunch of cells. They acquire an exclusive right to sell Peppo in Africa. So exclusive territorial rights for Peppo sales in Africa. They get there, the witch doctor meets them, feels threatened by them selling some alternatives to his traditional medicines, locks them up in a jail, but they escape the jail because the African guards, depicted as sleepy apes, are sleeping. They rush over to the king's tent. They get in because the king's sleepy apes are sleeping rather than guarding. And they go over to the king, who they're grateful that he, lucky for us, Mickey says, he sleeps with his mouth open. He pours some Peppo down the king's throat. And the king wakes up immediately. He says, yippee. Mickey says, it worked. The dark-skinned, ape-like African king says, hello, strangers. Welcome to Bambula. Mickey says, Mickey King, you've just had a sample of Peppa. Would you like to order a case? A case? I'll order a carload. It's wonderful. I've never felt better in my life. At which point the witch doctor enters again, and the story goes on about how they beat out the witch doctor to have influence with the king. Now, apparently, there was no editor at Disney Corporation who saw this and said, we might have a problem here. No, it was just as Harry Anslinger could hold profoundly racist views for a 40-year career in the federal government, Walt Disney could produce a cartoon for kids, a comic book for kids, that portrays Mickey as a drug dealer and Africans as lazy apes. I don't think it gets more racist than that, my friends. I just think that that is a stunning window on what race and addiction were like in the 1950s. Vestiges of which can be seen much later. I'll give a couple examples of that. Here's something from the Nixon years. This is a quote from John Ehrlichman. He was special assistant to the president for domestic affairs. And in 2016, he gave an interview with Harper's Magazine in which he said the following. The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. So here's just about as craven a little bit of politics as you can find. They simply knew that they were misleading the American public about the connection between opposition to the Vietnam War and drugs, and the extent to which blacks used heroin. A small minority of all blacks, just as was the case in today. But that's a pretty racist, clearly a sort of a weaponization of the relationship between addictive substances and racism. You weaponize that and use it for a political gain. It's just a despicable example from now relatively modern, into the 1960s already. Just a couple more examples. I want to talk about crack, and specifically about the way crack and crack babies were portrayed in the media in the United States in the late 1980s, early 1990s. You'd see two kinds of images most commonly. One would be something like this. You know, some addicts never had a chance to just say no. You hear, you see this, obviously very ill African-American infant in an intensive care unit, and you wonder, how could any mother do that to their child? The other really common image would be just an article with a mugshot. Akron parents accused of mixing crack cocaine, having guns in the same house as child. So it's just, here is a troubled person doing bad things. That's the story. And I want you to contrast that with this image, which is an image from the current opium epidemic in the United States. This is, again, New York Times, 2018, did a special feature on children of the opioid epidemic. And notice that it's a white child, a white mom. And the subheading for the article is, in the midst of a national opioid crisis, mothers addicted to drugs, struggle to get off them for their baby's sake and their own. So you're offered this sort of narrative to explain the behavior of this mom who exposed her child in utero to opium. That sort of narrative that's favorable to the mom never occurred when the issue was crack babies in the late 80s and 90s. But here, a little bit later, you see a very different and I think a very racially tinged change in how the public is encouraged to see the opium epidemic. Now, I do not have time to talk about all the things that we could talk about, racism and addiction. You see it in the everywhere in the criminal justice system. Disproportionate arrests, disproportionate prosecutions, disproportionate incarceration. You know, the disproportionate sentencing between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. There's a long list of things like that that are very, very troubling about the connection between racism and criminal justice in America. But I just don't have time to talk about everything we could talk about here. I did want to end with some thoughts on disproportionate access to treatment between communities of color and the white population in America. And instead of me talking about that, I'm going to show you a short video from Dr. Helena Hansen, who's quite well informed about this. So I think this is 5 or 6 minutes. Let's watch this and then I'll come back.
In the United States, we've long struggled with harm reduction, and actually I think that racial stereotypes have been a big barrier. Harm reduction hasn't been a major part of the national agenda until now. And so now that the racial image of who's dying and who's becoming affected is changing, now it's on the agenda. And for the first time, American policymakers are beginning to look to Canada and beginning to look to studies that have been done of harm reduction approaches. This morning I gave the example of Staten Island, which is a largely white, middle class to affluent borough of New York City. And in Staten Island, there is a comprehensive program by which the district attorney, the prosecutor there, if anyone is arrested on opioid possession charges, rather than pursuing sentencing, he's agreed to have them referred to treatment and be matched with a peer who's in recovery from opioid addiction. That is a 180-degree turnaround from the normal punitive response that we've had to drug possession in the US. Now, I say selective decriminalization because that's happening in Staten Island, but it's not happening in the South Bronx, which is actually where the majority of overdoses are taking place at this point. It's a Black and Latino low-income area where rates of overdose are actually going up, and they're beginning to rival Staten Island's. We're not seeing that approach anywhere else, actually, in the New York City area. So, and this is being replicated throughout the United States in that it's predominantly white neighborhoods where law enforcement is changing and decriminalizing around opioids and a new emphasis on treatment.
The truth is that I have really no idea how to end this segment. It is a pretty distressing narrative of the connection between racism and addictions of various kinds, addictive substances of various kinds, that is present throughout the entire history of the American experience. I suppose a few observations at the very end might be helpful. First, the use of the expression systemic racism has come up a lot more frequently recently than in the past, and it gets, or at least so it seems to me. And I think looking at the history of racism through the lens of addiction provides some evidence to support the notion that racism is pretty systemic. It's like everywhere you look, there it is. Sometimes it's hiding in plain sight. It's so much like water to a fish to us that we can that you find comic books for kids that are just about as racist as anything else that I can think of. That's suggestive of a culture so saturated with racism that it is like water to a fish. It's like you don't notice it. It's kind of jarring when someone points it out. And that suggests that if you're doing ministry that assumes that racism is not a significant issue, you may be missing some important information or important opportunities to see more clearly what's going on in the world around you. It may just be a sign of not being fully embedded where we are. We may be sort of disconnected somehow. And that's a situation in which having allies from different cultural perspectives, different racial perspectives, can be enormously helpful to us. So cultivating relationships of that kind, putting yourself in places where you're likely to be exposed to a variety of different perspectives from different cultural angles, is just, it's going to make any kind of ministry you do, I think, more effective. And it may not be obvious at first why that's the case, but that speaks not to that. That again speaks to how systemic racism is in our particular cultural context. It's so comprehensively a part of our lives that it's just very difficult for us to see sometimes. That's very paradoxical and confusing to us, I think. It is to me. Now, I realize that none of you none of you felt like you really needed any more depressing input this week. And here we are at the end of a reasonably depressing presentation. The only thing that it's really the only thing I can say about that part of things is, if you can't look clearly at the darkness, it will never occur to you that you need to light a candle. So find some way to light a candle. That's my bottom line for today. It's the best I can do. Blessings. Hope you guys have a good day. Bye for now.